Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I understand we want to talk a little bit about salary increases, eh? I'd be happy to proceed in whatever direction you would care to, and we'd prefer to have as much of a question and answer session as we possibly can, but if you would like, perhaps I will retrace the series of events that led up to the infamous memo of the chancellors and the president to various House and Senate leaders. Would that be helpful to do? Okay. Many of you read the newspaper article. I did distribute through the deans and the vice chancellors the memorandum that we actually sent to the leaders of the House and the Senate and asked that various meetings be held with employees to discuss the matter and to explain the philosophy. But if you haven't seen that, perhaps you would give me a few moments to read through that letter verbatim, and then we can proceed from there. How many have already actually seen and read the letter? Okay, most of you have not. Those of you who have, if you'll bear with me for a few moments. Essentially, it was addressed to the Honorable Jay Curtullo, President of the Senate, the Honorable Don Bennett, Co-Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and the Honorable John Sackett, Co-Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Additionally, on the House side, it was sent to Speaker of the House, Representative Joe Hayes, and Finance Committee Chairman, Representative Al Adams. This is dated May the 19th, 1983, and it reads as follows. The Senate has recently passed and sent to the House committee substitute for Senate Bill 82, which provides all state employees, including University of Alaska non-bargaining unit personnel, a 5% plus $5 a month salary increase retroactive to January 1, 1983. While we are most appreciative of your action and the inclusion of the university in this bill, we cannot, in good conscience, support the notion of retroactive salary increases for university personnel. However, we wish to support strongly the inclusion of salary increases for university personnel in Senate substitute for House Bill 105, which calls for the continuation of salary increases into fiscal year 1984. The dollars contained in this latter bill would be available for utilization July 1, 1983. We think July 1, 1983 is the appropriate time to initiate salary increases on behalf of University of Alaska personnel. Our action in writing to you is prompted by a number of concerns relative to the university's operating and capital budget requests for fiscal year 1984. As we are all aware, the state has limited resources, which has caused a number of reductions in the university's continuation level budget. We would like to propose that the $3.4 million in general fund for retroactive salary increase contained in committee substitute for Senate Bill 82 be utilized in the following manner rather than for the retroactive salary increases. One, restore the equipment reductions across all units of the University of Alaska system. Two, restore travel reductions across all units of the University of Alaska system. Three, restore funding for UAITC, that's the University of Alaska Instructional Telecommunications Network. Four, fund selected increments in the University of Alaska system budget for the remaining balance. Total general fund restoration, $3.4 million. We truly believe that it would be in the best interests of the state to forego any retroactive salary increase for the University of Alaska and to put the money into needed programs and service elements. The reduction in equipment currently in both the House and Senate versions of the university's budget will just place us further behind in the ability to update our immense equipment needs. Modern technology continues to advance, and all units of the university should be at the cutting edge of providing students the best opportunities to learn on modern updated equipment. While we realize that there are legislative concerns relative to the university's travel budgets, we think the reductions currently called for will have consequences on our instructional programs, as well as the ability of our faculty to communicate with colleagues across the nation and present to the world the best face of the University of Alaska. Much creative activity is performed by the faculty. In order for Alaska to take its leadership role, it is necessary that opportunities be provided to present this information to the nation and to the world. The University of Alaska instructional telecommunications system is still in an embryonic stage. The reduction currently called for will have a major negative impact upon the ability of this unit to engage in appropriate production for the delivery of educational resources to rural Alaska and other areas of the state. Finally, enrollment growth throughout all branches of the university continues, and it is necessary to provide operating funds to meet these needs, as well as to bring on certain new programs. In our view, this would be a much wiser utilization of the $3.4 million in general fund resources provided by the Senate. We would also like to point out that we feel that this position is consistent with the university's compensation policy, which calls for salary increases to begin with the new fiscal year. The cost of living increase was provided to all university personnel on July 1, 1982. We think these increases should be appropriately granted effect. We think new increases should be appropriately granted effective July 1, 1983. As included in Senate substitute for House Bill 105. In doing so, we will remain consistent with the new compensation policy established by the Board of Regents last June after a year's review and development by various groups throughout the university. This compensation plan has been put forward to the board and a policy by the statewide assembly and a policy adopted. Thus, a redirection of the $3.4 million in general fund would be internally consistent, as well as a better utilization of the resources in the best interests of the state. Finally, if the funds contained in committee substitute for Senate Bill 82 cannot be redirected into restoring certain of the reductions in the operating budget, we would request that it be utilized to fund the much-needed equipment currently contained in the university's capital budget request and the much-needed building repairs and renovations. We wish to reiterate that we are appreciative of your concern, but also feel that we could put this limited source of funds to much better use than that originally proposed by the Senate. That was signed by the chief executive officers of the system, the five chancellors, including myself, and I must admit to being perpetrator of that piece of correspondence, and so feel free to take issue with me if you feel I was out of line with that. Let me address a couple of items, though, in terms of what led up to it. First of all, this letter was written, I believe, either 24 or 48 hours after the Senate had passed the bill referred to and had sent it over to the House. I think what led up to our position was the following. 2 years ago, the Board of Regents, through its statewide administration, constituted a compensation policy review group through the statewide assembly. We had a representative on that group as well as other campuses throughout the University of Alaska system. They worked in conjunction with the Statewide Office of Human Resource Development for most of that year, and in March put forward a proposed compensation plan for the University of Alaska system. That plan was then translated into a Board of Regents policy, which was adopted by the board in June of 1982. To make a long document relatively short, the plan included three major items. One, that the first priority for the system was protection of real income, and this was to be done as much as possible in any salary increases provided. Two, and here we run into some disparity perhaps across the various campuses, but there were two other factors: continuing satisfactory service, which we have in the past referred to as longevity increases, and meritorious performance. The issue was that other salary funds should be divided in some fashion on a yearly basis, determined by the board in conjunction with this policy review committee, the distribution of percentages into continuing satisfactory service and meritorious performance. And those were to constitute the three elements of the compensation system. This policy then was adopted by the Board of Regents on June 24, 1982. It reads as follows: the University of Alaska recognizes its responsibility to students and to the citizens of Alaska to develop a compensation program which will enable the institution to attract and retain highly qualified employees. The university also recognizes its responsibility to continue to work cooperatively with its employees through the university governance structures to ensure that the university's compensation program treats all employees equitably, provides for protection of real income, rewards exceptional performance, and recognizes continuing satisfactory service. The university shall reward excellence of achievement within the system through a compensation program reflecting the following goals. One, internal equity, assuring that the relationships of salaries within the university is fair and just. Two, external competitiveness, assure that the university can compete in the marketplace for faculty and staff capable of contributing to the university's pursuit of excellence in teaching, research, and public service. Three, performance-based pay, assuring a reward structure which recognizes those employees who make outstanding contributions to the university's mission. Salary structure. The university's salary structure shall be composed of 20 ranges. Each range shall be divided into quartiles for the purposes of placement of newly hired employees. Movement within each range shall be achieved through adjustments for the protection of real income, exceptional performance, and continuing satisfactory service. I believe it was that policy, along with the following item from the compensation plan put forward by the assembly, that prompted the chancellors to act as they did. In the salary plan put forward by the statewide assembly, there is the following: annual salary adjustments. Annual salary adjustments should be determined by April and become effective on July 1 under the conditions specified in Part C1 of this report. The annual increases on July 1 shall utilize all funds identified as being available for salary adjustments for the fiscal year beginning July 1. It is recognized that from time to time some increased pool funds will be needed to be allocated outside of this process, such as correcting for salary inequities. However, the administration is urged to make every effort to secure such adjustments from other sources to increase the salary pool. I guess on the basis of that policy and that plan, it was certainly my feeling, and I'll speak only for myself at this point and not for the other chancellors, and in fairness to President Barton, let me point out that he was not present at that meeting. He was represented by Executive Vice President Carter, and Executive Vice President Carter signed that letter on behalf of the statewide administration. But I guess that it was our feeling that what we proposed was totally within the compensation plan and the compensation policy. We built a budget over a year ago that called for salary increases, and we built that budget for salary increases to begin July 1, 1983. We never built a budget request for any retroactive salary increases. We never requested the governor, the Senate, or the House to include us in a retroactive salary bill. Let me perhaps address why we do have a retroactive salary bill for other state employees. Virtually every employee in the state, with the exception of the commissioners and the deputy commissioners, the appointments essentially, is a member of a collective bargaining unit. Their contract dates are generally January 1 through December 31st of any particular year. So their contracts expire on the calendar year, as opposed to our contracts, which expire on the fiscal year. Thus, when they negotiate a new contract and seek funding, they seek funding back to the date of the expiration of the contract. So for all state employees, with the exception of University of Alaska personnel and state commissioners and deputy commissioners, their annual increase date is January 1 of any year and not July 1. Those same state employees did not receive a salary increase last July 1. They received their last salary increase January 1, 1982. That distinction has not always been noticed for University of Alaska personnel, and so to some extent our continuing inclusion in the past in retroactive salary increases, which have generally been paid across the board, just tied into that particular quirk. All of the items that we requested for restoration in the letter that I read to you were items that were currently being reduced from the university's budget. At the present time, 50% of our equipment request has been reduced by both the House and the Senate. At the present time, the House has reduced all travel funds by 10%. The Senate has reduced all travel funds by approximately 15 to 17%. This occurs at a period of time when we have some stated objectives to provide faculty and other employees at times with the opportunity to engage in professional development across the system. So we find those reductions particularly unfortunate. The University of Alaska Instructional Telecommunications Consortium was reduced $500,000. That cannot engage in any instructional program development without restoration of those funds. So I must admit that certainly in my mind, it seemed rather nonsensical for the legislature to be expending state funds on something that wasn't requested while essentially reducing our budgetary request for those items that we did seek. One final item, and then I'll open it up for questions, and that is the House adjourned. As you know, it's adjourned at least twice so far. Both times it adjourned without taking any action on either the retroactive salary increases or the forward funding salary increases. The Senate has had as a priority the passage of salary bills, both retroactive and forward funding, but the House adjourned twice without actually acting on those bills. So to some extent, you might argue that our letter was moot anyhow because they were not taking action for anyone. I think that's about all that I can address relative to correct or incorrect rationale as you see it. On behalf of the administration, whom you perhaps thought had gone crazy and berserk entirely by turning funds back to the university, but that I think is the context in which we did. I'd be happy to respond to any inquiries or other comments that you have. Anyone? Yes, please.
One question.
Could you sort of identify yourself with the entire group too?
My name is Bob Mock. I was just wondering, I was reading the bills, I got a copy of the bills, and the one that you were talking about was 82, House Bill 82.
I referenced two bills.
The one about the retroactive is the one.
Do I have both?
Well, anyways, in that bill it states the sum that you gave. $3,791,000 is allocated for University of Alaska employees not covered by collective bargaining.
Right.
Now, what I'm wondering is, does that encompass everyone, every single one on the university, like yourself and like the president and like...
It encompasses
everyone.
Except for approximately 280 employees who are collectively bargained within the community college system. The faculty of the University of Alaska Community Colleges are collectively bargained. Their contract expired March 31st of this year. So their appropriate start date for any salary increases, if a negotiations issue is ever resolved, would be April 1. They did not receive any base salary increases last July 1. But other than that group of approximately 280, it would constitute every other employee within the University of Alaska system. Anyone else? Yes, Dean.
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused by where the status of this is right now. What's going on?
Well, I think the status of state government in general is probably very confused at the present time. The adjournments that I referred to earlier really had to do, as you're all aware, with the issue of confirmation of governor's appointments to positions of commissioner and other boards and commissions. The House did not wish to confirm. That issue was finally resolved, I guess, about 10 days ago. Both the House and the Senate are back in session. The House, prior to its first adjournment, had already passed a budget and had sent it to the Senate. That budget did not contain any forward funding for salary increases, nor any retroactive funding for salary increases. That budget is still the official House budget. The Senate has passed a budget, state budget, which also does not contain that, but they have also passed and sent to the House CSHB 226 and SSHB 80, both the retro bill and the forward funding bill, and they passed those and sent those back to the House. Now that they have listed it amongst their 20 bills for priority consideration this session. So the House must now take up the consideration of both of those salary bills. The Senate has completed its action on both. The House has not. For any positive action on either forward funding or retroactive funding, the House must pass either or both of those bills. There is one other alternative, and that is that they could refuse to do it and they could somehow add it to the budget in the free conference committee, I guess. But that, does that answer adequately enough? Sort of in the House's court right now. Yes, please. Peter.
I'm Peter Vigo from the Department of Business Administration, and I'm concerned about the way salary is going to be calculated. You mentioned protection of real income, continued satisfactory performance, and the third one is meritorious service.
Yes, sir.
And so far, I haven't seen anything that is going to help us identify how to evaluate meritorious service.
Okay. Let me address that the issue of concern that everyone seemed to be expressing earlier was retroactive, which would have been just straight across the board. But relative to forward funding, the Board of Regents should be taking up the issue at its meetings on June 23rd and 24th, essentially next Thursday and Friday. They must reach a decision for distribution of any potential salary money across the three factors. I think at the present time there is solid agreement throughout the university on the protection of real income. That's based on the Anchorage CPI, which is 1.8% over the past year. So the first 1.8% of any salary money received will be given across the board to all employees. Let me put all in quotes for a moment, because I think there is one issue that is debatable in that. Would be given across the board for all employees. The issue that on that part of it that I think is debatable is whether or not an unsatisfactory employee gets protection of real income. I think there is a divided point of view. I suppose philosophically my own point of view is if it's really a protection of real income factor, all employees should get it regardless of the evaluation. There is another point of view throughout the university that says if you are an unsatisfactory employee, your reward is not an increase for protection of real income, but continuation on the job for a period of time. But understand that there are very few of those types of evaluations. There is a division, I think, between the other two factors. Let us presume that it's roughly 5% or something like that. By the way, I have taken the position that some funds be reserved for promotional increases, which was part of the original plan. But let's presume roughly on 5%, approximately 2% of it goes to protection of real income, leaves approximately 3%. The Assembly Committee originally proposed that 0.5% go into meritorious and the balance into continuing satisfactory service. I must admit that the chancellors have taken a different position recently and that we feel there must be at least 1% and preferably 1.5% provided to the meritorious service element and 1.5% roughly to the continuing satisfactory service. How would implementation of those two factors work, whichever way it turns out? Let's take continuing satisfactory service for a moment. Anyone who was rated satisfactory on their annual evaluation, which should have been completed within the past 6 months, or actually within the last 3 months, would receive whatever percentage, let's say in this particular case, 1.5% across the board, in addition to the 1.8% protection of real income. So anyone who is satisfactory or above would be at that point working on approximately a 3.3% salary increase. As it pertains to meritorious service, whatever the factor arrived at is there, we are committed to trying to have those decisions occur at the lowest level possible within the organizational structure. So that would probably be like physical plant as a unit. It would probably be school of management as a unit and that type of thing. It is my intention to distribute the funds as a percent of salary base to those units for that factor. Let's say it's 1.5%. 1.5% of the salary base gets provided to the unit. Our recommendation, and we don't know if this would hold, would be that those who, on the Likert scale of 1 to 5, those who had a rating of 4 would receive, let's say 1.5% was reserved, would receive another 1.5% on top of PRI and CSS. Those who received a 5, and I get confused as to whether that's outstanding or excellent on our scale, would receive an additional 3% on the basis of those evaluations. Now, if the unit has essentially awarded everyone outstanding and excellent evaluations, there will not be a sufficient enough money to go across the board, and they will have to take it out of their other operating expenses to implement it. But that would be the plan here. I'm not sure, or proposal here. I'm not sure what would happen elsewhere. Okay, not sure who was first.
Who will make that determination on
the final analysis of what percentage you go out of the board? The board may restrict it to some degree. I think the board should deal with the maximum percentage allowed for meritorious service. I think that's appropriately a board decision. After that, then it would be ostensibly a decision provided to each of the chancellors of the various campus. My process would be to bring together the administrative committee of the assembly and the executive council, who would be the legislative and executive arms of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, to arrive at a decision relative to the rest of the distribution and what would go into that. What I've given you earlier, you know, would be the proposal that I would, at least at the present time, consider putting forward. Kauf. This is Dr. Jayawira, by the way, who is president of your assembly.
I just want to tell you that the administrative committee will be meeting with you on Monday.
Right.
But going back to your retroactive,
yeah.
I just want to go back to the retroactive aspect, which was the purpose of this meeting.
But, you know, whatever you want to make of it.
I'm speaking on behalf of the assembly, and I have had some requests from the members of the assembly after the group.
Okay.
Number one, what was the reason for this urgency? Why do you have to have this letter sent within the 24 to 48 hours after the House members passed? Number two, were there members of the statewide assembly invited for this meeting? If so, who and
okay.
Why was they here?
The meeting that I referred to was a meeting of something called the Statewide Policy and Budget Team. Why was it urgent and did it need action right away? I forget exactly the date. I think I said it was May 19th or so. The Senate had already passed the bill and had sent it over to the House. The issue of confirmations was very hot. Adjournment was likely at any particular point in time, and so rapid action needed to be taken prior to either passage of a bill or adjournment in order to have any type of viable input. That, again, though, I want to reiterate, I strongly support policy development through the legislative arm of the university. I don't think we can always administer by committees. I suppose the second question to that is, why no consultation with the local assembly? I think, one, there was the timing and urgency. Two, it was certainly my opinion that the action taken was absolutely in concert with board policy and assembly passed plan. And so as long as you're working in concert with existing policy, you're merely executing actions there. Was there a member of the statewide assembly there? Yes, there was. That member was the chairman of the chairman of the statewide assembly budget team, Dr. Roger Sheridan. Now, let me hasten to add that Dr. Roger Sheridan abstained, to the best of my recollection, on the vote to send this letter.
Was the president of the assembly invited for this?
Yes, the president of the assembly was invited to attend the meeting. As you are aware, the outgoing president of the statewide assembly happens to be Merritt Helfrich, who at that point was beginning to feel somewhat schizophrenic because he had already begun to assume the position of associate vice president for human resource development, and so Dr. Sheridan sat in on his behalf as his appointee. Well, actually, both of them are members of that committee, excuse me. Yes, sir, I saw you earlier, and I'm sorry I neglected.
With this new plan, where does this leave employees that are not evaluated, such as temporary and student?
Temporary, by definition, are not eligible for continuing satisfactory service, certainly. Nor would they be eligible normally for the
meritorious.
Whenever you do an across-the-board salary increase, such as protection of real income, the temporary scales would inflate by whatever percentage you would be there. So I would presume, right now I'm talking about, temporary. The only salary increase that temporary employees would be eligible for would be the 1.8% protection of real income.
That's where I don't really think it's fair, because there's people in this campus that are employed as temporary for years. I myself have been temporary for two,
mm-hmm.
and probably be temporary for at least two more.
Mm-hmm.
And I know down at the physical plant, they keep you on temporary at times, simply so because they don't have enough permanent positions available, and
not
also because that way they don't have to put you onto the all the nice little benefits that you get.
Supposedly not any longer.
What's his name?
Supposedly not any longer. Anyone who would exceed the 6 months total allowable continuous service, I think if you are, say, summer temporary, on and off, it probably does. What I'm going to
say. Year round, I'm temporary.
You're permanent
temporary?
No, excuse me.
Right,
sounds like we have some of those.
The four of us here, and plus I know a lot more, temporary year-round. We work full-time in the summers and during most of the vacations.
And you're not students.
Yes, we are students, too.
Well, that's a special category, I'm afraid.
Well, it's not covered. That's why I was wondering.
I agree.
1.8, which under your thing where you said everything should be fair to all employees, it seems that there seems to be a little bit of a snag here. There are a lot of student employees, and I think that I've heard anyway that there's plans to be a lot more openings for student employees.
Mm-hmm. I think you've raised a valid point. First of all, let me just address the temporary issue. As a continuing service employee, unless, correct me if I'm wrong on this, you cannot exceed 6 months without automatically being kicked onto a permanent position line and benefits provided. Is that right? The option is either to be laid off at the end of the 6 months or to kick into a permanent position line. Now, that doesn't include the student classification. I think you raise a good issue that has been neglected in the policy. I'm not sure that there was discussion of it at the time that the plan and policy were developed. I don't have an answer to you other than the protection of real income at the present time, and to say I think you've highlighted an issue that probably needs to be addressed in the future. It's less than satisfactory relative to this distribution of funds, I admit. Yes, sir.
You said the $3.4 million. And you said there were four regions that it was going to go into. One would be travel, another would be equipment, and so forth.
Right.
I agree with the equipment 100%, and the others I'm unfamiliar with. But as far as the travel, you said that, I don't remember the figure you said that would go into travel budget, but you said that this would be for the various
right.
Which I agree in principle, although you would have a select number who are having a benefit that is not given to the rest of the employees. And my point is that you're saying that the retro should not be given out for the betterment of the university, which I agree in principle. But on the other hand, you are allowing a select few travel and have a benefit that is not available to everyone. And my question is this: how is the travel budget determined for each department, and how is the individual in the department, how is it determined that they get to travel and how much and so forth?
Okay. Let me back it up a moment. First of all, understand that all we were asking for was restoration of a continuation level budget in the three items that I requested. Okay? Those were reductions, and we were asking that reductions of funds be restored, not that additions of funds be made to those items. Restore the reductions. Two, let me state that in my opinion, faculty travel is not a fringe benefit. It is an absolute necessity to keep our faculty current, to provide them the opportunity to be maximally effective instructors by interacting with their colleagues across the nation and across the world. So I would not maintain that it is a benefit, per se, okay? The travel budgets are less than equitable across the university. We're attempting to impact those by putting funding into those units that appear to be somewhat lacking. I would specifically highlight the College of Arts and Sciences, I suppose, where there is not a sufficient amount of travel money, to the best of my recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, if anyone knows it, to allow each faculty member to travel at least once to a national meeting in their area. I don't believe that if all members of the College of Arts and Sciences were to travel in a single year, that there would be sufficient funding to provide for that, okay? It is normally done by reserving a certain amount for departments, department heads and dean, in some form of consultation, makes a decision, I suppose, who would travel. And I've seen it done different ways. If there is insufficient funds for full reimbursement for that travel, sometimes 300, 500 is allowed per faculty member or something like that. Other times, it's an every other year arrangement, or it varies substantially once you get down to the college and departmental level. So the budgets are inequitable. The decisions are primarily dean decisions, with one exception. Currently, if it's out of state or international travel, it's a gubernatorial decision at the present time. But generally, it's dean and department level.
Well, to go on, I define benefit as something in addition to salary. Is this in addition to your base salary?
It is not provided to the individual faculty member to use at his or her discretion. It is a reimbursement for necessary expenses incurred in the performance of their duties. And again, I would argue and maintain that the need of faculty members to engage with their colleagues nationally and internationally is an absolute must if we intend to grow in excellence.
Let me just speak a little bit to that. In the College of Arts and Sciences, people find the fact that national conventions pay out of those sound lots that we have. My take is trip to a national convention. If I go to my national convention next year, it's going to cost me out of my own salary probably over $1,000. That's in addition to what it is. It's normal in our college, it's the university will pay 20% and the rest of the.
Let me say that some of the public opinion messages reaching the legislature took particular exception to the restoration of travel funds, and I think some of the wording used in those public opinion messages so that faculty members can go off on a junket or something like that at your salary expense. I really think that that is a misrepresentation of the facts. Someone else? Anyone else? Yes.
My name is Diane Brandy. I'm still sort of new to the state and don't fully understand the legislative process.
Changes every 2 years, so.
From your letter that you gave back, is there any guarantee? Does the legislature have to do what you say, or can they make the
free? Right. They can do anything that they choose with that. Including withholding the retro salary increase and not doing any of the restorations that we proposed, yes. We do not have the authority to appropriate state public funds as we choose for the university. That is by law provided to the legislature. The governor himself cannot appropriate funds. He can veto or reject appropriations, but that is very specifically by law a legislative function. They don't have to do anything that we request.
In other words, the money is not necessarily earmarked and then.
That's correct. Yes, ma'am.
So it is conceivable that we could end up with no retro, no forward funding, and no restoration of those budget items that you mentioned.
That is, I would give that at least a 50-50 probability.
I think it's worth facing, dealing with mentally
right
now.
Okay. Again, understand that I and all of the university administration support strongly and actively any salary funding bill effective July 1. And again, lest any of you begin to feel that you might be giving up something that you had briefly and fleetingly in your hands there in terms of a retro salary increase, we never requested it. It is not consonant with the plan and compensation policy.
But even at that, it was only the Senate who had said that that was a possibility in the first place. The House has said zero funding.
Yes, but the Senate has said it is a piece of priority legislation, and we will not adjourn until you deal with it. That means they can't beat, or they can deal with it and give it a negative vote, but I doubt that's going to happen. I think there'll be a salary increase, but that's strictly you know, whimsical thinking. Yes, sir.
Let's say they ignore your request to have the retroactive passed over into other parts. They do pass the retroactive, they do pass the hard funding. What then?
Okay. That also is likely that they, yeah. They could entirely ignore the request, pass the bill, and provide the retroactive funding to the university. Officially, at that moment in time, it becomes a Board of Regents decision, and they'll have to address whether or not they wish to recant on their existing, even if they receive the funding for retro. My individual recommendation would be to recommend to them that they not provide the retroactive salary increases and that they utilize the funds, if the law permits, to implement other needed activities for the university.
Which would go against the policy for the...
No.
That you just read.
No, sir. The policy that I just read calls for salary increases to be effective July 1. Oh, you have to understand that retro and forward funding are duplicative items. If you were to take 5% from retro for a half a year and add it to 5% forward funding, you don't have 10%. The forward funding 5% is merely carrying forward into the new fiscal year the actions from the prior fiscal year. So it would have to be used for one-time only expenditures. You could not totally increase the salary pool because the maintenance money in the forward funding portion wouldn't be there, if that's what we're talking about. Yeah.
I was just going to say that was an earmarked appropriation for Red. We'd be hard-pressed to use it for anything else. Both politically, as far as the legalities are?
Well, Senator Sackett has thus far indicated that he would like to test the board's resolution as it pertains to its compensation plan. I must admit that that sort of tickles my heart a little bit, too. And that he maintains the law and the wording of the bill would permit the board to do other things with it. Now, I don't know. I'm not a legal expert on that, but... Yes, sir?
I wonder if through with the questions on retroactive, if you would be willing to discuss for a few moments the status of the university
in general?
Yeah,
sure. No. Let me just ask the question. Did anyone want to add or ask anything else as it pertains to retro? Could I, Don, go ahead and stay with that for a moment? I'll come back to that.
Thanks, Judy Osmond. I just have a question. They get 5% retro. That's across the board, everybody gets it, right? I mean, if it turns out you have to spend it as retro, be across the board, everybody gets it, or would it still be on merit and longevity? And is that in lieu of merit and longevity after July 1?
The issue of how to distribute a retro really hasn't been addressed. I would maintain that it could probably be done either across the board or you can do it across the board, provided you pay it as a bonus and don't add it to the base, I guess. If you do it across the board and add it to the base salary of the employee, it automatically, you know, throws in a 5% increase in the forward funding. So you couldn't do that. You could, of course, calculate the salary increase effective July 1 by the three categories and just apply that backward, I guess. I think that would be possible. Retro?
Retro.
Okay.
Yeah, one One thing that puzzles me about this town is that we've had retro increases about every year that I've been here.
Yep.
Has the university not requested those?
University has and has not. It's been inconsistent. It's partially dependent on what happened the July 1 prior to, as to whether or not we have. To the best of my recollection. Hey, listen, we're just getting to be a new responsive and responsible agency. I think the key difference is this. The key difference is what happened June 24, 1982. And at that time, a cognizant decision was made after a year-long activity that said, we no longer wish to dovetail our salary increases along with all other state employees. We wish to implement our own compensation system. Up until that time, we just sort of followed along after the state employees and took whatever came out in that particular process. So I think there was a cognizant policy decision a year ago that has changed that. That's the key difference that I would say exists. You look less than satisfied with the response.
I just think the amount of money that I'm not going to get out of that would certainly take you to be 100 years old.
Yeah, but you never had the money to begin with. How come you didn't challenge us when we put forward our FY84 budget without a request for a retroactive? That would have been the appropriate time to bring up the challenge and say, hey, listen, you guys, we always got retro in the past. Put in some money there for retroactive salary increases.
I never saw the budget to know that you didn't.
Okay.
In the document that you refer to,
let me just. No. The dates are mentioned as I quoted them earlier in the plan. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've got a question on your compensation plan concerning the students again.
The universities?
Yes.
Right.
Are we going to have to go to bat for ourselves?
Pardon?
Are we going to have to go to bat for ourselves, or is there going to be someone looking after our interests when the raises come around?
For this distribution.
I mean, should we let our student president know and get him to get on the ball?
I think that's certainly appropriate. I can't address what will happen at this distribution. You know, we're sort of in the 11th hour on that. Let me suggest that I will write your student body president here, at least, and ask that we convene a group to make some recommendations on how to handle student salary increases and student employee category for the purposes of salary increases in any future increases. Would ask that he constitute such a group this next year. Yeah. Let me say that, you know, because there was something about union dues and that type of thing, that always sort of tweaks me to action. I've got to tell you that any contract, whether negotiated or non-negotiated, right now we have dates that say July 1 through June 30th as our contract period. That's all there's ever going to be in a union contract. Going to be a start date for the contract, it's going to be an end date for the contract. Not going to be any retroactive salary increases back into the contract for the period that was already negotiated. It's always going to have a start date. And that start date might be January 1, but that means you get an increase on January 1 and not July 1. That start date could be April 1, could be July 1, can be any date you want, but that's not going to change the state of events for retroactive salary increases. No. Yeah. No one ever negotiates contracts like that.
One thing that puzzles me is why is the university on a separate system than the rest of the state? I'm unfamiliar with why they chose July 1 rather than January 1. Is there a reason for this?
Well, I think it's basically because it's the fiscal year number one, and so we always budgeted by fiscal year. Number two, we are a quasi-state agency. We're constitutionally mandated, and so therefore are not the same as other state agencies. And number three, because, as I mentioned 2 years ago, a group was put together which essentially recommended that we try to withdraw from the process of just dovetailing onto state salary increases and begin implementing our own plan for salary increases. And one of the primary factors, I think, that people wanted to get in there was a tripartite type of system of merit, continuing satisfactory service, protection of real income, which doesn't happen on the others. They're more across the board. You know, if you don't like the existing plan, I think, you know, input to the committee and get that changed. Retro? Or Sally? Yes, go ahead.
I think one of the reasons we start on July 1, because there's a teaching function around here, it doesn't make sense to hire faculty within the school year.
That's generally true.
I'd like to ask a kind of technical question. You were talking to the question about the allocation of the contingency money.
Yes, sir. Yes.
At least as far as faculty is concerned, my understanding is that promotions always set up our agenda. What kind of promotions are we talking about?
July 1 or September 1, depending on when you start. We're talking about those faculty promotions, but we're also talking about potential APT and classified people who could have been promoted at any time over the course of the year. Some of those, there is no specific date for those promotions, but to provide funding for those promotional increases. Status of university budget in general. The university in general is being treated no better nor worse, I think, than any other state agency. Essentially, the issue seems to be the fact that there's not much money out there in the future, and that the state has, over the course of years, built up a continuing level of government function, including college and university education, beyond its capacity to adequately support. Most state agencies are receiving at least a 5% reduction, with the exception of the Justice Department, which is actually, and the State Department of Administration, Justice Department, is actually receiving a substantial increase, primarily, I think, for staffing of the jails and a variety of things that have occurred because of lawsuits, et cetera, et cetera. All other state agencies are essentially taking a 5% cutback. The university is taking, in a way, a 2.5% cutback, but not totally true. Right now, we have three budgetary levels. This is system-wide. We have the governor, who recommended approximately $152 million of state general fund system-wide. We have the House version, which is, to the best of my recollection, approximately $153 at the present time. And we have the Senate version of the budget, which is roughly $148 million. They went into free conference committee today with the Senate and the House versions of the budget. This is just the operating portion, not the capital portion I'm talking about. So we expect that we will come out someplace between 148. 148 is virtually actually the same dollar amount we have today, not even inflationary increases to some extent. But they made some specific reductions. They made the travel reductions and the equipment reductions that I referred to earlier within those budgets. Additionally, they funded some of our increments, but didn't add new money. And then they gave us an undistributed 2.5% reduction that we would have to take out of our budget someplace. For the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the House version would provide approximately $1.4 million more money than the Senate version. So evidently, we're supporting the House version of the budget. And we hope something between the two. Projections are that they will end by their goal is to bring this session to a conclusion by the 23rd of June. This morning, though, it was announced that they were about 2 days behind their schedule, so I think you might look for someplace around the 25th of June. But they are in free conference committee open today. So we're getting close. Be in court all next year, I suppose, over the commissioner's appointments. But anything on anything else? Board funding, retro funding, university budget, academics.
From the subject a little bit, but it relates to the budget. Last year, the fiscal officer planned to have a meeting. A meeting for all the employees. And I asked this particular question, which I don't feel I received an answer satisfactory. I asked this particular question. I said that I was a student. I graduated, but I was a student at that time. And I was an employee of a physical plant. And I have an immense pride in the university. I'm proud that I go here, and I have a pride in it that I want to see it become better. And my question was, what was your feeling, or what was the administration's feeling, on people in the university, students who participate in malicious damage? And at the meeting, Staples Brown said that it was the position of the physical plant and the position of the administration that whatever was damaged would be fixed. If it was damaged 10 times, it would be fixed 10 times. And I don't know if you're aware of an article that was in the paper by it wasn't by Dick Stenard, but it was an interview with Dick Stenard that said there was a few $1,000s damage a year. And I take acceptance with that figure, a few $1,000s, because I have seen a few $1,000s damage on the weekend. And this is eating into the salaries, it's eating into the equipment, it's damaging our reputation as a good school.
I think I have the gist of your question.
The answer that I received was the chancellor, if something is damaged, it will be fixed. And I asked about disciplinary action. And I have talked to Dick Stenard, and I have talked to you before, and I've talked to Harris. And the answer that I seem to get is that if something is broken, it'll be fixed. And very rarely, to my knowledge, has a student ever been severely reprimanded. I know they have, but I don't think it's on an equal par.
Right, okay. Philosophically, there are two things that caused me, I suppose, to really see red at the university. And student services has my philosophic position that, one, any student in a residence facility who causes harm to another individual on this campus is to be removed from that facility as soon as possible. I cannot abide that violence against another. Two, any student in a residence facility who causes damage to that facility should also be terminated from the residence. I believe Dr. Stenard believes there's sort of a buildup, you know, $5 damage as opposed to $1,500 damage. Probably he sees some variation in what happens. He has regular disciplinary procedures for that. My directions to physical plant are that I want continuing progress made toward upgrading the physical plant of this university. And I do so on the philosophic basis that if people live in a pleasant, clean, well-maintained environment, they have a greater vested interest in maintaining that environment in that condition. And that, so yes, they are under directions to repair the damage. You know, it's not physical plant's job, I think, to determine cause of the damage. I think their job is to repair the damage. It's Stenard's job to deal with the rest of it. Listen, I apparently...
Ignore the
note. Okay, excuse me. I had a note here that said there was another meeting, but that she just canceled that. There is no other meeting. Go ahead. Still on my desk at the present time, I will act on it shortly. I am leaning toward striking the dual titling, but keeping some type of non-tenure track possibilities. I'm not real happy with the dual titling portion. And this sort of a doesn't look equitable.
You don't have a timetable then?
Yeah, probably. It's getting pretty close, isn't it, Colt? It's real short. Yeah. I don't remember exactly what it is. Yes, Dana. Currently contained in the House Capitol bill, $11 million for new student residents. Our drawings are all done. We're ready to issue the request for proposals as soon as we know we have money in hand. We, at the present time, expect that it will be in the final version of the bill passed by the legislature. We are slightly more optimistic that the governor won't veto it, but there is still a high possibility out there. If they really do adjourn by the 25th, we plan to issue our request for bids immediately, even before the governor acts. You know, we'll put some sort of caveat language on it. So, say, roughly July 1 to July 31 will be bidding time, award by August 15th, mobilization and on the job, hopefully by, you know, September 1, September 15th, and still shooting for fall 84 occupancy. Yes? Not funded in the capital budget. However, $1.5 million of additional planning money put in. And that would give us approximately $2 million, which would permit us to go through architectural drawings. And that we would have to request it again in FY85. It would probably go on to GO bond and go before the voters then in November 1984. Earliest possible construction time being summer 1985. Start of construction, at least. Yes?
My name is Dan Miller. I'm interested in life sciences. Once again, I feel like a lonely voice in the wilderness in that when we start talking about pursuit increases, what we're doing is we're aggravating differences between pay levels. And if we talk about protection of real income, yes, that does protect a standard of living. But when we talk about other forms of add-ons...
You mean merit and satisfactory service?
What happens is differentials widen. And
sure. They do. Let me say one thing. The ranges won't widen. You know, the ranges are capped. But it would allow one employee to proceed toward the higher end of his range, her range, at a more rapid pace than another employee. And I think that's specifically addressed in the compensation policy that I read, because I think it attempts, in addition to protecting real income as based on inflation, so that you don't lose buying power, so it's a CPI, consumer price index factor, that's utilized there. It also seeks to distinguish the performance of employees. And I think that that's a reasonable thing for it to do. And it also seeks to reward employees who have just, you know, continued year after year to provide good service.
Exactly. So when you have a person who's, I'll pull a number out of the air, making $2,000 biweekly, their 3% merit is much more than the person who earns $850 biweekly. And
sure.
The gaps every year continue to widen.
Let's see. 10% on 2,000 would become 2,200. 10% on 1,000 would be roughly 1,100. One reason.
And the next year, if you get another 5%, the gap widens further.
Only to a maximum point, I believe, because of the salary range, which is based on the job, on the job classification, right? And so it automatically caps at some point. So that can only happen within a range, and those ranges were, best of my knowledge, established after looking at the various jobs within the university, evaluations of the job descriptions, et cetera, et cetera.
Were those ranges then defined by a percentage difference between top and bottom or a dollar difference?
talking about?
I don't know the answer to that question. Anyone from personnel left?
Yeah, I have a question for that part. That would be the resource development statewide.
Dollar difference, I'm told. Dollar difference.
So when you reach the top, when they still give a 1.8% real salary, you lose that because you reach
the top? No, you would lose the other variable factors at the top, I guess, would you not?
No, also not that.
Oh, then they're not capped.
To you, even though you have ranged, you reached the maximum, however, it would not go on your salary base because you cannot exceed your salary base.
So it gets paid as a bonus at that point?
As a one-time increment. If you are outstanding this year but you have maxed out on your salary range, obviously if you are basing compensation on performance, you should receive something. So you would receive it as a bonus.
You would receive the entire year?
No, you would receive the performance factor as a bonus, because all the salary ranges move with the inflation factor. Okay?
The CPI would keep the ranges continuing up depending on what's happening with inflation.
Okay, but you would receive the entire merit raise as a bonus at the beginning of July 1, say, for the entire year.
Right.
No. Maggie, what?
I think she's saying, would you receive that whole lump sum at the beginning of the night?
I can't imagine that we would forward fund a whole year's salary bonus. I don't know how it would work, I guess.
Well, I don't know. Let me put it this way. That is one of those hypothetical things that hasn't even occurred.
It's reached it.
Nobody has reached it yet. However, we have tried to make the provision. So I've introduced myself. I'm Hunter Wilm. I'm a terrible person who is your contact a year long person between the statewide assembly, the Board of Regents, and the local assembly on the compensation policy. I'm the one who's done all this in conjunction with the administration. May I just say here that they have done a very good job in interacting with the employees through the assembly governance body. They have tried their darndest to keep us apprised, to keep us informed. The Board of Regents is now creating a new committee to deal with human resources. Because of the legislative problems we've had, they wish to be able to be knowledgeable about what we're paying here and why we're paying it, and can they say to Senator Sackett, well, you're all wet because this guy really should get that money, but should not. So they have formed their own committee, and they're not meeting in the dark behind closed doors. Before they ever met, they made it very clear to the statewide assembly they wanted immediate contact with the employees on the statewide level on what they are discussing and what they will be doing. So I have attended this meeting. I have tried my very best to look out for the interests of the employees, sometimes to the dismay of Chancellor O'Rourke, President Barton, or the region, whom I apprised that the idea of giving back the retro money was very novel indeed, and that's what I'm thinking of it. We obviously will have to deal with, and I'm glad to see that Dr. O'Rourke is doing that here, and he's giving us their version. The way I have seen the role of the committee that I'm serving on is a sort of semi bargaining unit. In other words, we're not formalized. We do not expect to get everything that we want and ask for, the same as the administration does not expect to have all their wishes fulfilled. So we come to the table and we talk about it and we try to resolve the issues to the best of the institution, because I think that's really what we're all after. Of course, the initial reaction is, hey, I want that money. However, if the institution needs it more to become, to remain viable, to be able to attract students and teachers that make it what it is, well, then perhaps we have to show the way and say, all right, I'll tighten that belt a little notch. We get money forward, that's good enough for me. I don't necessarily need it back so I can share it with Uncle Sam. Anyway.
Let me just add a point to that. You know, I think a year ago a lot of people took exception to the role of the assembly, say, in the budgetary process. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Assembly is the legislative arm of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Now, like it or not, that's the representative body with which I'm going to deal. And I think if you have input on any matter, academic affairs, personnel policies, salary and compensation, you must contact your representative, volunteer to serve on a committee, and participate in that process. Carl, any comment on it?
Yeah.
each college, each group has a representative.
And I think for classified and APT, they try to work first through the staff support council and then through that group into the assembly representation. Sir? The ranges, I think you would essentially view as being non-person specific and applying to the job per se. The quartile then would be a means of placing individuals within a range. And then after that, the tripartite protection of real income, continuing satisfactory service, and meritorious performance would really be factors applied to the individual within that. Well, PRI wouldn't. PRI would apply to the range, really. The other two factors to the individual. But in the past, the movement annually has been relatively automatic within some percentage increase. With the new policy, that will be automatic movement. Well, let's see, the range moves up, actually, for the PRI, right? The entire range goes up. So you're not moving up within a range because the range is going up, essentially. Continuing satisfactory service and meritorious performance will allow individuals to move at different rates within their range. Depending on how you, is that answering your question? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I have some questions regarding at the university stall.
Yes.
Do you have enough money to cover the English 111 at Tuna?
Let me say that I think if our enrollment increases around 5 to 6%, we're okay. Once we start getting beyond 6%, we've got some problems. Whether I'm just trying not to face the future adequately or not, I'm saying around 5%. Partially because we have an automatic cap, I think, built into our situation in terms of residence halls. Residence halls have been virtually filled since early in the spring, I would guess around February 1. Of the 1,400 single student beds that we have, 1,050 of those beds were claimed by returning students, leaving only 350 beds available to new students. So I think that's going to have a flattening effect on that front-end enrollment. We'll try to deal with it. Anyone, anything else? Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Yeah. 200.